Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We have Eric Holder coming up on today's show, the U.S. Attorney General under President Obama. He's now chairman of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, so a lot to talk to Eric Holder about regarding the past and present. He's the co-author of a new book called Our Unfinished March, The Violent Past and Imperiled Future of the Vote, A History, A Crisis, A Plan. I think it'll be interesting to get Eric Holder's plan for voting rights in this country, considering everything that's going on. We're also going to ask him, yes, if he has a plan for abortion rights, too, considering the news. And I have a feeling he's going to connect the two. So that'll be with Eric Holder in about an hour. We'll also continue our series, 51 Council Members in 52 Weeks. It's week 19. We're up to District 19 as we enter Queens for the first time in the series. Those districts go numerically borough by borough. The first 10 are in Manhattan. The next 8 are in the Bronx. Now we enter Queens, starting later this hour, District 19, with City Council member Vicky Palladino from Northeast Queens. And we'll end the show much later with a call-in with all this big national and international news that we must talk about a lot these days. Roe versus Wade, Ukraine, everything. Hyperlocal stories are sometimes lost in the shuffle. So we will have a call in later in the show to invite you to share the local news, the most local news from your block or your neighborhood. What's going on that could or should or would make the news? But we begin here. According to the National Institutes of Health, an estimated 1 in 4 of all pregnancies end in miscarriage before 20 weeks. Now, a miscarriage is not an abortion, so why are we talking about this? Well, in light of the leaked draft from Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito to overturn Roe versus Wade, activists and healthcare providers are saying that making abortions illegal could have a negative impact on miscarriage care. That's because some of the same medications and procedures used in abortions are also used to safely end miscarriages. The impact on providers, for example, can be chilling, and then that trickles down to an impact on the patients. Maybe you saw the op-ed in the New York Times, the column, really, by their parenting columnist, Jessica Gross. She wrote, "Doctors wind up being afraid to conduct any procedure that may be misconstrued as an illegal abortion, even when they're treating patients who miscarry. Women can then wind up with little choice about how their miscarriages end, sometimes simply having to wait to miscarry, quote, naturally, which may take weeks and risk their health in the process." That from Jessica Gross's parenting column in The Times. Joining us now to discuss the impact of overturning Roe versus Wade on miscarriage care is Dr. Kristen Brandy, obstetrician, gynecologist, and board chair with Physicians for Reproductive Health. Dr. Brandy, thanks so much for some time today. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
And listeners, we'll open up the phones for you right away on this. If you're a healthcare provider who takes care of patients who are undergoing miscarriages, can you share how abortion and abortion rights intersect with compassionate and medically necessary miscarriage care for some people? Or if you're someone who was having a miscarriage and received medical care for it, what do you want to share about that experience that might be relevant in the context of the new threat to Roe? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And obviously not just the new threat to Roe, but the states in which abortion is already severely restricted. Maybe any of you listening are not just in the New York area where we broadcast from, but around the country in some of the states where maybe this is already an issue, not waiting for the Supreme Court. So, Dr. Brandy, that stat might be shocking for some people to hear that 1/4 of pregnancies end in miscarriage. As a healthcare provider, what is the range of reasons for that?
Sure. And I would agree that many patients that I see with miscarriage are shocked to find out how common an experience it is that one in four pregnancies end in miscarriage. And it can happen for a number of reasons. Sometimes it's related to a person's health, where pregnancy may be dangerous for someone and their body knows that and kind of starts the miscarriage process. The most common reason is actually related to genetic abnormalities in that pregnancy that the body, again, recognizes and ends the pregnancy. But many times we don't know. It's really hard to get testing after a miscarriage. And so it's really challenging sometimes to find a reason why.
NBC News recently reported, quote, the same clinical skills used in surgical abortion procedures are often the same as those needed to clear the uterine lining after a miscarriage to prevent serious complications, unquote. So can you explain the medical procedure that is commonly used in miscarriage care that they're referring to there and in what circumstances it's applied?
Sure. So you're right that the procedure that people would undergo to clear a uterus after a miscarriage is the exact same procedure that is used for procedural abortion in the first trimester. It's called a dilation and curettage, short term for D&C. And it's a procedure essentially where we use a vacuum to extract all the tissue inside the uterus. And it has a whole bunch of reasons, a whole bunch of applications that we use it for outside of pregnancy, someone that has heavy bleeding, someone that has potential endometrial cancer. So it's a procedure that's used for a lot of different things, including abortion care. I'll also mention that the medication we use to treat people with miscarriage to help them go through the process of a miscarriage is the exact same regimen that we use for medication abortion in the first trimester. So exact same care, but being used for different applications.
And why is that? Those procedures and medications didn't always exist. What sorts of complications are we talking about, from physical ones to mental health outcomes to whatever, for people who have to continue to carry the fetus after it's clear that they are or are going to miscarry?
Sure. I mean, it can be really traumatic for someone to know that their pregnancy is not normal, it's not going to continue, but to carry that pregnancy. It takes potentially up to 8 weeks for someone's body to undergo the miscarriage process if no intervention is done. So again, some people might find that pretty traumatic. Some people, this is a very desired pregnancy and either are in a grieving process or want to get pregnant again very soon. And so waiting sometimes is not a great option. As far as complications medically, sometimes this process, because it takes a while, sometimes there's a risk of infection or during the process, a risk of heavy bleeding or hemorrhage that may even require a transfusion. So there are some risks for waiting, but generally, if you wait several weeks, it is a process that will undergo itself with very minimal complications, and medication and procedure also are very, very safe.
And talk about the medication. You talked a little bit about the D&C procedure. Some of the same medications used in abortions can also be used for managing a miscarriage, I see. What are these drugs and what do they do?
Sure. So there's two medications typically that we use for both miscarriage and abortion care. The first one, called mifepristone, or Mifeprex is the brand name, is a medication that helps both stop the pregnancy from growing in an abortion case, as well as soften the cervix and helps the next medications work better. Usually 24 hours later, patients will take four pills called misoprostol or Cytotec. Those medications help cause the uterus to cramp and bleed to help pass the pregnancy in either case. So again, exact same medications being used for different purposes, but the same general effect of emptying a uterus. And it's really challenging because these medications are the same thing. If there's any type of restrictions around the mifepristone, for example, which is highly regulated by the FDA, those restrictions not only impact abortion care, but they also impact people's ability to get this medication in the case of miscarriage.
When would a person ending their miscarriage and their doctor decide to do one procedure versus another, or let's say the D&C procedure versus medication, or are they used together?
Usually they're done separately, but really it's a conversation, at least that I have with my patients, in a shared decision-making fashion, meaning that I explain the pros and cons of both. They're different experiences that people feel. But luckily, both of them are incredibly safe. Medication abortion is 95% effective, and the same goes for successful miscarriage management. DNC is 99.9% effective. So very similar effectiveness levels. So really, it's based on what the patient wants to experience during this process and letting the patient decide what's best for them.
The experiences are different?
Yes. So with the medication management, again, it's very similar to what people typically describe as a miscarriage. It's very crampy. You have bleeding that can last for several hours. The DNC is a little bit more invasive because we are doing a procedure, but it's something that takes about 5 minutes. It's can be done in an office setting or in a hospital with different levels of anesthesia. So again, different experiences, and patients may have preferences about which one they would prefer.
Before we go to some calls, and even more explicitly, why banning abortion would threaten quality miscarriage care, I want to ask you a terminology question. At what stage is a pregnancy loss, which is sometimes referred to medically as a spontaneous abortion, called a miscarriage? And what's it called afterwards? And why does the word abortion even get in there?
Sure. Well, I think it's always interesting because medical terminology is often different or interpreted differently than what I'll call lay terms. So medically, an abortion is any pregnancy that ends in the first trimester in early pregnancy. Spontaneous abortion implies that the body does it on its own, versus what we typically call abortion, we often in medicine call an induced abortion, meaning we did something to intervene. So all pregnancies that end in the first trimester, and even in the second trimester, really under 20 weeks, we call medically an abortion, regardless of how it, you know, came about. After about 20 weeks, often refer to this, depending on what happened, in a preterm labor or in intrauterine fetal demise, usually after 20 weeks or so.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about why healthcare providers are saying that making abortions illegal could have a negative impact on miscarriage care with Dr. Kristen Brandy, an OBGYN and board chair with Physicians for Reproductive Health. I think it won't surprise you, Dr. Brandy, that with just that one mention that I made at the top, our lines are full with people who either want to tell their stories or ask you a question. 212-433-WNYC. You can also tweet at Brian Lehrer. And here I think we're going to get a 40-year-old story that may portend something about the future. Mary in White Plains, you're on WNYC. Mary, thank you so much for calling in. Hello.
Hello. Yes, back in the 80s, my husband and I very much wanted to have children. And we got pregnant several times, had seven pregnancies, but five ended up in miscarriages. In each of those cases, I had to get a DNC. In one particular case, the doctor asked me to lie and pretend I was bleeding when I was admitted to a Catholic hospital. And in another case, I had to cross protest lines to get my procedure. It was very traumatic.
What was that like, crossing the protest lines? Did people scream at you or anything?
Yeah, people screamed, and, you know, it was just, I was a strong believer in a right to abortion at the time, so I was annoyed enough at them as it was, and as a matter of fact, my congregation used to routinely on Saturdays walk people across protest lines who wanted to have an abortion. So, you have chin up and you have to do what you have to do. They weren't going to deter me. And I wasn't going to stop and tell them my story because, I had my own thing I had to deal with in that moment. But thank you for giving me this opportunity
to tell that story. You weren't
even
going in for an abortion. You were going in for care for a miscarriage.
Exactly, for a baby that I really, really wanted.
Mary, I hear how it's painful even now to tell that story, and I'm sorry, but I appreciate that you did because I think it's good for the other listeners to hear it. What are you thinking as you hear that story, Dr. Brandy?
I mean, I'm really sorry that you went through this process, but it's unfortunately a really common process that many people undergoing miscarriage go through. People like myself that specialize in abortion care also often specialize in things like miscarriage management. And so that care happens in the same spaces, including abortion clinics. And so patients may have to go through the process like this person did, through walking through picket lines and trying to, you know, manage this emotionally as they are also, you know, being targeted by abortion protesters, which, like, was reflected as really traumatic for some people and shouldn't be a way that people have to, you know, get care.
Let's hear somebody else's story. Here's Alexis in Port Washington. You're on WNYC. Hi, Alexis.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm okay. Thank you.
Good. So my story is, and I guess there's a little bit of a question as well. I experienced an ectopic pregnancy several years ago, and it ultimately had to be treated with methotrexate. And this happened only several months after I had already had a laparoscopic surgery. And there was obviously the potential of another laparoscopic surgery. And I happened to be on blood thinners at the time. So it turned into a really dangerous situation really quickly. And I guess I never had put myself in that category of women whose lives could be in danger by their pregnancy. And I guess I'm just wondering how this would impact women who have ectopic pregnancies.
Dr. Brandy?
That's a great question. And something that, unfortunately, a lot of people in practicing in places that have abortion restrictions are trying to figure out. For those listening, an ectopic pregnancy is a pregnancy that, instead of implanting in the uterus, implants somewhere else, like the fallopian tubes, the ovaries, which are really dangerous. As they grow, potentially they can cause, in the case of a pregnancy in the tube, they can burst the tube open and cause hemorrhage. That is a medical emergency. The concern is that it is a pregnancy, and in order to fix the problem, you have to end the pregnancy. And some people may interpret that as an abortion, even though it is medically necessary care. So it's really a challenge for people in abortion restrictions, and something I'm really worried about as more states undergo restrictions, that care like ectopic pregnancies may be something that providers may not know exactly if that's something that they can provide or not, which can be, you know, catastrophic to people's health.
One more in this set of stories, and then I see we have another OBGYN provider calling in. Leslie in Brooklyn, be patient if you can. We will definitely get to you. Michelle in San Francisco is next, though. Michelle, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in. Hello from New York.
Hi, Brian. Good morning. Yes, I mean, like all of the callers, I have a story, and I wanted to share. I am somebody who has had three miscarriages, and it's just the miscarriages itself has been traumatic. Also, when I was younger, I had an abortion, and I think having those options is crucial, and needing to, from what my experience having an abortion, and then also my experience with my miscarriages, I had the care that I needed, and I am so grateful. And this kind of care needs to be accessible for everybody who's birthing, for everybody who wants or cannot have a child. I had the care that I needed. And to think that care is not accessible is absurd. It's ridiculous, because I was able to heal with each case, with each moment. I was able to heal.
Through the help of your providers is the point you're making, right?
Correct, yes.
Michelle, thank you so much for your call. So to that point, Dr. Brandy, I've read that countries like Malta, which has a total ban on abortions with no exceptions, and Poland, where according to Amnesty International, abortion is only permitted in situations of risk to the life or health of a pregnant woman or if a pregnancy results from rape, doctors are grappling with miscarriage care. So are you familiar with what kinds of decisions medical providers are having to make in some of these countries where the question the U.S. may be about to face is already in play?
Absolutely. And when I think about those countries, I get very worried. And I feel for the providers in those places that are trying to make these really challenging decisions. When abortion is illegal in a country, including potentially in the U.S., depending on what happens in your state, doctors are forced to make decisions that may not be the standard of care. We talked about that ectopic pregnancy example, where there could be a pregnancy with cardiac activity, where in that state, to end that pregnancy would be illegal, but to save that person's life, that's what's necessary. And unfortunately, in these places, that's the decisions that doctors have to make, and they risk, you know, their license, they risk their job to be able to provide that care. And I know for me, that sounds like a terrible, you know, choice to be between, to be deciding your patient's health versus, you know, your own livelihood and potentially going to jail, other consequences. So I'm, you know, really concerned about what's going on in our country. And I'm hopeful that we can find a way that doctors can continue to provide care for patients that we know is the standard of care.
One story along these lines from another country, it's, let's see, it's unclear to me which country this comes from, but this was in The Guardian, reported after the death of a 30-year-old pregnant woman in November of last year. It says she died of septic shock after doctors refused to provide miscarriage care because the fetus's heart was still beating, though not viable. And the New York Times parenting columnist Jessica Gross writes, physicians may have been afraid to break the country's laws because the penalty is spending 3 years in prison. And that goes right to the heart of the dilemma that some doctors and other providers in this country may already be facing in some states, or may be about to be faced, about to face if Roe is overturned and all these trigger laws in various states go into effect. That the doctor was perhaps afraid to break that other country's laws in this case because the penalty was spending time in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Even though it was miscarriage care.
Right. And I never want to be at that crossroads where I, in a moment where I'm making decision for patient care, I know the right decision. I've had the medical training that, you know, that tells me based on experience and knowledge that this is the right choice. This is the best thing for this person. And I have to doubt my decision because of legal restrictions around this care, especially for things that in that particular case, using this concept of cardiac activity or a fetal heartbeat, which is complicated and hard to explain, but legally is very vague. And so it's hard for me as a physician to make a decision on a law that wasn't written by doctors. And it's hard to interpret in that medical decision because each pregnancy is really different.
In a no legal abortion state, would a fetal heartbeat be a bar to diagnosing something as a miscarriage?
Potentially. Just for people listening, the concept of a fetal heartbeat is complicated because, as you can imagine, everything is growing in pregnancy in different stages. We can start seeing electrical activity of what will eventually be cardiac cells as early as 6 weeks or so, which is the component of many of these new abortion restrictions in the South. But that doesn't mean that if that fetus or that embryo were to deliver at 6 weeks, that it would continue to survive, this concept of viability. And so having restrictions like this that target a particular type of development, when we know that there's no good outcome for that pregnancy, unfortunately, for some people, it's really hard. It's really hard as a physician to interpret these laws, again, because they're not written by medical providers and don't take into account all the unique circumstances of each individual person's pregnancy.
With Dr. Kristen Brandy, an OBGYN and board chair with Physicians for Reproductive Health, and Leslie in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Thank you for your patience, Leslie. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. First time caller, long time listener. Love you, Brian, and the
Thank
show.
You.
And I'm very appreciative, Dr. Brandy, and this current segment. Safe to say that I feel fortunate practicing in New York, which I feel will, I'm hoping, will always be a safe haven for women nationally to come and seek care that is standard to our practice. I would just like to echo that what Dr. Brandy has already disclosed is that abortion is health care, and I cannot imagine practicing in a state in which, even before last week, our practitioners are subject to restricting the conversation that is so personal to the patients that they serve. I myself, you know, we have cases in which clients have, and Dr. Brenda can also expound on this, second trimester cases where clients, where, you know, loss can happen. The water can break in pregnancy at 15, second trimester, and the standard of care is to offer clients the termination of the pregnancy that is not going to be viable or not going to proceed to a normal term pregnancy. So what happens to those women in other states? I feel that, you know, I will always be a purveyor for reproductive justice in my practice here and forever. So I'm personally not fearful of what can happen to me within the care that I provide, but it is very important that I continue to be part of that, if you are a salutary practice in medicine for just basic standard of care for women.
I hear your commitment and that maybe you're ready to be part of the effort to make New York a sanctuary state, as some elected officials have already referred to it, if these trigger laws do take effect in a lot of other states. And it's already happening. There are already thousands of women coming to New York, from what I've read, from states that have severely restricted abortion rights. Are you worried, though, about the kind of scenario that we were just talking about and some of the legal scenarios that you've probably been hearing, where a state like Texas, where bounty hunters can, under their law, report people who are providing what are their illegal abortions to women from Texas, and whether some of these states may try to come and go after you in some respect here?
I would just like to express that I'm not driven by fear. So I feel that, and in practice also, and in living in New York State, that there are entities which will protect us. There are legal scholars, entities that will shield us potentially from these bounty hunters, if you will. I became a physician for a certain reason. I became an OBGYN for these reasons, to provide care for my patients. And nothing's going to stop me from doing that, and no bounty hunter is going to prevent me from doing so.
Not driven by fear. Leslie in Brooklyn,
no.
Thank you so much for your call.
Important. Thank you. Keep it coming, please.
Thank you. Wow, Dr. Brandy.
I echo a lot of Leslie's statements that I hate the thought of having government or this legislation restrict my ability to provide the best care that I know I can provide to patients. And this is why I went into OBGYN. This is why I'm an abortion provider, is because I want to be able to provide the best care for people, regardless of, you know, what they need. So, but I know that's, you know, a privileged statement that I practice in New Jersey, a state that is also has very few restrictions, and I'm very fortunate to be able to do that. I know my friends and colleagues that are providing this care in other restricted states like Texas aren't as lucky and aren't able to navigate the system as easily, because, you know, their own lives are on the line, their own careers are on the line. And that's a really heartbreaking place to be in.
So to the story that we were telling before the break from The Guardian, of the death of a 30-year-old pregnant woman that turns out to have been in Poland, which I didn't say before. I didn't know, but my producer now told me. And the woman died of septic shock after doctors refused to provide miscarriage care because the fetus's heart was beating, though the fetus was not deemed viable and the doctors may have been afraid to break the country's law. There is the Texas Heartbeat Act, which bans abortion after the detection of fetal cardiac activity, which does typically happen, like you said, around 6 weeks into a pregnancy. I'm seeing that six other states, Georgia, Kentucky, Louisiana, Missouri, Mississippi, and Ohio, have similar laws, according to a New York Times article in 2019. And in her article called "These Laws Are Making Miscarriage More Traumatic in America," that New York Times parenting columnist Jessica Gross wrote, an early draft of a Missouri bill seemed to outlaw treatment for an ectopic pregnancy, which happens, as you were describing before, when a fertilized egg implants outside the uterus. And that bill has since been amended, I'm seeing. But as a doctor, can you talk about what problems you potentially run into when lawmakers legislate health care in this kind of way? If ectopic pregnancies are not viable in any circumstance, which I believe is the case, why would they even be talking about ending one as a Class A felony in Missouri or any state?
I think, unfortunately, it's just that the people that are writing these laws don't understand the medicine, and they don't understand the people that need this care. That, you're right, like this ectopic pregnancy, I remember a couple of years ago, there was talk about a lawmaker suggesting that ectopic pregnancies could just be moved to the uterus and then could continue normally, which is not something that exists in science and medicine. But it just goes to show that people that are writing these laws don't necessarily know that. And I don't fault them for that. But I would prefer that people writing laws have understanding of medicine and not create more barriers to the care that people need. That case in Poland, I'm thinking about patients that I think Leslie also mentioned that will break their water early in pregnancy, where it is very clear the standard of care in medicine is to end the pregnancy, because otherwise, as that poor person in Poland experienced, they can become infected, that infection can travel around the body, go into shock, and people can die. And it's really a scary thing to think about how legislation, laws could prevent providers from providing the care that patients absolutely need to save their lives, and doing so just, you know, because of fear of breaking the law. And that's not how medicine should be practiced.
Here's Laura in Brooklyn, who says she's graduating med school this week. Laura, you're on WNYC. Do I have that right?
Yeah, thank you.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, my question for Dr. Brandy is, in med school, I've been very involved in medical students for choice and various abortion activism, but I'm going into internal medicine because it's just my professional interest, but I'd like to stay involved in abortion activism and abortion care if possible. So what are the roles that you see for non-OBGYN physicians in this struggle?
Mm-hmm. Well, first, congratulations. I know it's a long road, so I'm glad that you finished that step of medicine. I think
thank you.
Non-OBGYNs play a crucial in abortion provision, reproductive health care. I think many people think that OBGYNs are the only people that provide care to people that are pregnant. But internal medicine, family medicine, emergency medicine are all people that could potentially take care of people at various stages of pregnancy. So I think it's critical. And I think there are roles for example, internal medicine to have training within residency programs so that people can learn about early pregnancy management. It's also great for people that are providing primary care to do this work, because many patients prefer to deal with these complex issues around pregnancy with people that they know, with the providers that took care of them for their diabetes and, you know, hypertension. So I think it's a great idea. And also, we just need support in other forms of medicine. People that are providing abortion often are ostracized within medicine. And so having colleagues and allies in other fields is really critical for us to continue to do the work that we're doing.
Laura, thank you, and good luck out there.
Thank you.
Is there an opportunity, and don't tell anyone, I won't tell anyone if you tell me there is, for doctors in illegal states to perform abortions and say they were miscarriages?
I mean, I would not recommend people overtly break the law. I think it's interesting that miscarriages and abortions are so closely linked, and often it's something that medically people can interpret in different ways than the law. Because I think the law is very vague and doesn't necessarily have this, you know, basis in medicine. I trust doctors to make the best decisions that, you know, are based on their training. So I would not overtly tell people to break the law, but I would tell people that they should use their best medical judgment. And I'm hopeful that they can provide the care that is within that medical judgment if they need to.
So last question, you're a doctor in New Jersey, where Governor Phil Murphy has signed abortion rights into law and passed by the legislature there as, you know, the opposite of a trigger law. Like if Roe is overturned, abortion will remain legal in New Jersey. And you're part of a national group of providers dealing with this issue. So maybe this is a crazy question, but if a person is going through a miscarriage in a state where abortion is essentially outlawed, or in one of the trigger states that will make abortion illegal if Roe is overturned, where do you even begin to advise that patient on how to obtain miscarriage care and protect themselves from prosecution, whether it's mistaken or not?
Sure. Well, one, I'm just very fortunate to be in a state where our governor, as you mentioned, passed a law to protect our patients, our people, from unnecessary abortion restrictions. And I know that's not the case for other places, that other places are going to be going the exact opposite direction. I think something that is not talked about enough, both in the abortion debate, but also how that ties into miscarriage, is that care often is disproportionately difficult to access for certain marginalized groups, like people of color, low-income people, LGBTQ people, undocumented people, young people. And so when I think about people in restrictive states and how are they going to get to like my state in New Jersey, in New York, they may not be able to just because of logistics of travel and childcare and all the things that people need to consider in the ability to access care. People that are doing great work that are helping people access care that may have difficulty are abortion funds, organizations that raise money to help people cover the cost of their care, but also cover logistics of like childcare and travel. So those organizations are doing great work to help people get into care. And different organizations like the National Abortion Federation, there's different networks that people can look in their local area and kind of find questions or find answers about where do I go, what places are open, what places will take care of me, regardless of the care that they need. And so I'm hopeful that people will become aware of more resources so that way they can, if they need to travel, find information about where the best place is to go.
And there we leave it with Dr. Kristen Brandy, an OBGYN and board chair with Physicians for Reproductive Health. Thank you so much for coming on with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Take care.